everyone, and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Raquel Medeiros, a current first-year student here at Queen's Law. Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. It's also accessible to listeners anywhere. This week, the topic is on children within the family legal system. Disclaimer: this podcast does not contain legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains a general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. In today's episode, I hope to share with you my journey into the topic, followed by the current outlooks on children's rights in general and within family law. By examining the current laws and legislation on children within the law and how they came about, a foundation will be built to which a discussion on children's perspectives, scholarly controversies, key issues, and world impact can be explored. I invite you to follow me into the world of children's law within this podcast. I originally became interested in the topic of children within the law in my undergraduate studies. I was a psychology major, and I focused on taking courses that combine psychology and the law. One of the courses I took was the history of family law. With an open discussion assignment, I had the freedom to pick any topic within family law, and my focus ended up being on custody challenges. I must admit, I probably put a lot more effort into that project than most of the other people in my class did, but it was because I was astonished by the lack of input there was from children that were involved in custody cases. That led to my interest in getting to do my own research on the topic. This personal research ultimately drew me to Queen's for Law School, as there are some profound professors here who have done amazing research on children within the family law system, which will for sure be brought up later on. Let's get into it. The common law has evolved tremendously when it comes to children's rights, from children being treated as chattel to a focus on the protection of children's best interests. It seems as though rights for children have come a long way, and it continues to evolve to this day. For those who are familiar with the topic, some legislation that may come to mind when thinking about children within the law may include the Divorce Act and the Children, Youth, and Family Services Act in Ontario, but neither of these speak directly to children's rights. Children's rights are encapsulated in the 1989 United Nations Conventions on Rights of the Children, or the UNCRC, which has been deemed the most ratified human rights treaty in the world. Canada is a signatory of the UNCRC, which means that Canada signed the convention stating that the government would be in charge of ensuring that children's rights are respected and that children know about their rights. When it comes to legal process, Article 12 of the UNCRC consists of an important element of how children should be appreciated within the institution. For example, Section 12.1 states that parties shall assure to the child, who's capable of forming his or her own views, the right to express those views freely. In all matters affecting the child, the views of the child should be given due weight in accordance with the age and maturity of the child. Also, Section 12.2 states that for this purpose, the child shall, in particular, be provided the opportunity to be heard in any judicial and administrative proceedings affecting the child, either directly or through a representative or an appropriate body, in a manner consistent with the procedural rules of national law. It is critical to one's understanding that children are undoubtedly reliant on adults around them, and because of this, their rights within family law may become overlooked when the responsibility falls onto parents, lawyers, judges, mediators, counselors, and any other adults involved in litigation. With this in mind, to support the child in their participation in the legal process, these adults need to recognize their position as caretakers. Within family law disputes, there are many ways that children's rights are affected. These include: when a child is seeking relief through family law system in their own right, when a child is made a party to the proceeding in children's protection cases, when a child name or status is affected through adoption, immigration, marriage, or divorce, or when a child is subject of the court proceedings through their parents' divorce or separation, but is not a direct party in the proceeding, which will be the main focus for today. The sad reality is that there is a tendency to keep children out of the legal process. When it comes to being a party within the family law dispute, there are only provincial and territorial legislation protection for children 12 and over. But even this is heavily influenced by the adults surrounding the child and their support towards child's participation. Former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, Beverly McLaughlin, captured the essence of this topic when she said, "Where children's rights are at stake, perhaps more than anywhere else, reactive legal solutions are inadequate. It takes proactive attitudes in lawyers and judges to bring children's problems to light and to find solutions to them. Coming into law school, this has been at the root of my passion for family law, and I only hope to help spread awareness and education on children's rights within the family legal system through platforms just like Pro Bono Students Canada. McLaughlin had a lot to say about children in the court, so to no surprise, I have another quote from her. She noted that in order to find out what is in the best interest of the children, it seems logical to find out what the children think. How can you assess a child's best interest without hearing from the child? Preliminary research has been done in Canada on the way children are heard in family law proceedings. In Ontario, a court may make an order requesting the appointment of the Office of the Children's Lawyer, or the OCL, as a child's litigation guardian. OCL is a publicly funded office that represents children's legal interests. In family law matters, the OCL can provide representation for a child to support and protect their best interests. Sometimes, the litigation guardian is a lawyer or a social worker, and in special cases, a child may be provided both. The focus on a lawyer appointed by the OCL is not to advocate for what they believe is the child's best interest, but rather advocate for what the child expresses is their best interest. The only difference between counsel for an adult and children is when the child is unable to articulate their wishes. If the child can provide instruction, then they are entitled to be represented by counsel. However, more recently, the OCL has developed a policy that allows the child's lawyer to advocate a position that advances the child's interest, even if that position is not consistent with the child's instructions. With this, the child's lawyer presents the child's views while also cautioning against those views. The role of the child's lawyer remains an area of uncertainty in Ontario. Further, despite the court being able to make a request for a child's legal representation, the OCL has the overall authority to decide what services will be provided. For example, the OCL can override a judge's recommendation for legal representation and can either change the assistance required or deny it altogether. This then forces the court to be heavily reliant on the OCL for the child's assistance. But there is another option for children, and that is for them to get their own private lawyers to represent them in family law cases. This is typically funded by parents and a more costly option. Where this option may come to a halt with the court is when the lawyer is funded only by one parent in a family dispute. It may appear as if the one parent manufactured the arrangement in their own benefit. Outside of the lawyer, the judge may also play a part when children are involved in family court process. Section 64 of the Children's Law Reform Act, or the CLRA, provides the opportunity for judges to speak to children directly and privately in family law proceedings. Rachel Birnbaum and Queen's own Nicholas Valla have done extensive research on the topic of children and the law. In 2009, they conducted research on when this section came into action. They interviewed 30 judges in Ontario on their views when speaking with children. Most were reluctant at the time, and only 6 had ever spoken with a child in a private family law matter. The guidelines for how judges in Ontario should speak with children are not stringent, and the judicial meetings remain uncommon. Many believe that such meetings are inappropriate in courts and that judges are not equipped with the skills it would require to speak with children in this context. Though, this trend appears to be changing in other countries, such as England and Wales, after Birnbaum and Bala's research was presented there to develop guidelines for judges meeting with children. Countries like New Zealand and Scotland have a strong value placed on giving children a voice in the court. Judges in these countries regularly meet with children, even in situations where the child has already shared their views with a lawyer. Judges there have reported benefits in this process, such as satisfying the child's need to know who is deciding aspects of their life, giving the judge some responsibility for the child, and assuring the child that the judge is solely responsible in the final decision-making process. It has also been noted that when a judge meets with a child, it may enhance the judge's ability to make good decisions for children and allow the child's view to have been heard and recognized. Canadian family courts have relied on indirect accounts of children's views through the report of child welfare experts. The benefits of the expert reports counteract the possible issues that would come with judges speaking directly to children, such as the fact that the experts would have a better understanding of how to interpret the expressed best interests of the children in a complex family dispute. However, this method also comes with its limitations. Expert reports are restricted in giving children a voice as the child's views are being filtered through a third party. Thus, the child's view is not directly being heard. With such a variety of procedural options for children within the family court, in Canada, having personal communications with a lawyer who can represent them can be a strengthening experience for children who may feel voiceless in parental disputes. Let's transition into the role of children's lawyers. An important function of a child's lawyer is meeting with the child, providing advice, and helping the child develop a plan consistent with their perspectives that may be different from those of other parties. With this, the lawyer can adduce evidence and advocate for the child's plan in negotiations and court. But again, as with judges, lawyers are not given the adequate training required in law school to carry out this type of role. Guidance in Canada is limited for the unique role that lawyers for children are expected to play in representing children. Though, more recently, some jurisdictions have agencies responsible to finding legal services for children. Policies have also been recently developed to attempt to provide guidance, but none of which have been reflected in the Law Society standards. There is a need for the Law Society in every jurisdiction to provide these guidelines in family legal proceedings involving children. What is provided in every jurisdiction is a standard for professional conduct based on the Model Code of Professional Conduct of the Federation of Law Societies in Canada. While there is no specific guide for lawyers representing children, the Model Code provides guidance for relationships with clients with diminished capacity. Unfortunately, this would not apply to children who are capable of providing instruction but are unwilling to. It also would not grapple with children who are unable to appreciate the reasonable consequences of their decisions. The Model Code may also be difficult to navigate the question of whether counsel for children may have a wider sense of responsibility to the court than other counsel. Even though the Law Society does not provide any specific guidance for children's lawyers across all jurisdictions, Bala and Birnbaum in their article Rethinking the Role of Lawyers for Children, Child Representation in Canadian Family Relationship Cases, have described a suggested approach. A lawyer for a child in a family law setting can adopt one of three roles. The first is the friend of the court. In this role, the lawyer's responsibility is to make sure that all the relevant evidence is put before the court so they can make an appropriate decision. With this, the goal is to have all the options open to the court for investigation. The lawyer will do this by meeting with the child to explain the court processes and ensure that their view and perspectives are available. The downsides to this role are that there is no expectation of confidentiality between the child and the lawyer. As well, the lawyer is not necessarily arguing in the favor of the child's position or their best interests. They are simply just making sure that the views of the child are before the court. The second role that the child's lawyer can take is the best interest guardian. This role entails the lawyer to advocate for a position based on their assessment of the best interests of the child. Similar to the friend of the court, the guardian lawyer will meet with the child, explain the court process to them, and may also not feel obliged to maintain confidentiality about their communications with the child. They will bring forward evidence that states the preferences of the child, but may state that the decision that the child seeks may not be in their best interests. Some form of this role is expected in many jurisdictions. On its face, this role may seem controversial because of the lack of guidance and education, as mentioned earlier. The lawyer may also be too influential, as courts may place too much weight on the lawyer's views of the child's best interests. But many judges have a preference for this role, as they believe it promotes the fullest judicial understandings of the child's circumstances, hence promoting their best interests. The third role that the lawyer for a child may take is the instructional advocate. The Model Code mentioned earlier presumes this is the only role counsel for children should take. This means that the lawyer should have a relationship with the child in the same way they would with an adult client. The same ethical and professional responsibilities would apply as long as the child has the capacity to provide instructions. Like any other client, the lawyer should advise the child about the risks and benefits of different options and the likelihood of the outcomes with each option. The ultimate decisions that the lawyers will advance is determined by the child. Unlike the other roles, the communications between the lawyer and the child are confidential, and it is up to the child what will be disclosed to the court. Though this may seem like the most appropriate role, it does also come with its challenges. There is a debate about whether a child has the capacity determined by the Model Code to instruct counsel. In some cases, the child may express strong and consistent views aligned with one parent. The question is whether this view is a consequence of parental alienation or justifies estrangement from a potentially abusive or negligent parent for the child's rejection of that parent. There are also limitations when it comes to the child's development and their capacity for abstract thinking and future planning. This is especially cautionary when the arrangements being made involve relocation. Through these three different roles, a two-role model was developed: the child's lawyer instructional advocate and the child's right and interest advocate. The child's lawyer instructional advocate has the traditional foundation of the third role mentioned, the instructional advocate, but it is modified through the requirement of satisfying the child by having all the significant evidence relevant to the child's interests before the court and the parents, subject to the concern about the child's confidentiality. In this role, the standard for assessing the child's capacity should not be set high. Otherwise, very few children would meet it. The only things required for the capacity standards is that the child has a basic understanding of the main issues and the ability to express preferences about the outcome they want. Unfortunately, especially in high-conflict family situations, a child with adequate capacity may not be willing to fully express their views to their lawyer due to a fear of upsetting or rejecting one of the parents. In this role, the lawyer for the child must communicate in developmentally appropriate terms and provide information and advice in a way that the child can understand to be able to assert their position. While doing this, the lawyer should be careful not to impose their own views on the situation. If the child is unable to articulate their position, then the lawyer should take on the second option, as the rights and interests advocate. This is a combination of the friend of the court role and the best interests guardian role. Lawyers are not equipped with the training and education required to assess the child's best interests, but, like the friend of the court, the lawyer who is advocating for the child's best rights and interests should not disclose confidential information received by the child. The role is best fit for children who are unable or unwilling to give instructions, or in situations where the child has expressed some preferences but the counsel believe that the child lacks capacity, is unable to appreciate reasonable consequences of their preferences, or the implementation of this preference may put the child at risk of harm. A lawyer taking on this role is advocating for the child's protection or their rights and interests. This may include advocating to support the child's relationship with the family, culture, and community, especially in child protection cases. As mentioned throughout the rules, the lawyer must not advocate for an outcome based on their subjective opinions on what they think is in the child's best interest. The lawyer can offer the child to meet with the judge if they are within capacity and unwilling to take a position. Birnbaum and Bala expressed their advocacy for the government to take action on this and establish a program to provide flexible, comprehensive, and resourced approaches to children's participation in family justice processes, such as judicial interviews, views of the child reports, clinical assessments by mental health professionals, child-inclusive mediation, and child legal representation. I express these same thoughts, and I hope many of the listeners also feel the same way. It is important to realize that these programs would cost the government some money, but they would result in more settlements, ultimately saving the cost of court resources and legal aid. Of course, the more important outcome from these approaches would be the promotion of the child's well-being. As of now, there is no jurisdiction in Canada that has fully adopted this model, but there are movements in the right direction. With all the roles and models explored, it is clear that there is no single best way for courts to receive the evidence on the child's best interest in family cases. Lawyers and judges should consider many factors and ensure that the child's evidence is received by the court in an appropriate way. Bala and Patricia Eber's paper on the views, perspectives, and experiences of children in family cases explores this thoroughly. No matter what role or model the lawyer takes, there are a number of different methods that can be used as court evidence of the child's views. These may include hearsay evidence related by a witness, such as a parent, social worker, or teacher, video or audio recordings of interviews with the child, written statements, social worker or mental health professional reports, voice of the child reports, the child's counsel, testimony by child in court, or a meeting in the judge's chambers. Judges and lawyers take this evidence and try to give it the appropriate weight when deciding how to hear the voice of the child. They provide the court with as much relevant and accurate information as possible, minimizing the emotional stress of the child, and preserve the child's relationship with each parent, ensuring a fair process for both the parents and the child, and resolving disputes in cost-effective ways for the parties and the court. In this way, the child is involved in an appropriate manner with minimal conflict and a clear understanding of the child's preferences. Let's dive in a bit deeper into some of these reports that can be used. Bala and Haber noted that research has established that children can be very reliable witnesses, but children's memories are less well-developed than adult memories. This leads to a major concern with child witnesses and their potential suggestibility. I know through my undergrad research that this is a discussion that has been on many scholars' research for such a long time, and for all witnesses, but it is especially dangerous when it comes to child witnesses in any legal setting. Through repeated and misleading questions, memories of witnesses may become distorted and have the witness actually believe that some event has actually happened when it, in fact, did not. This also leads to the issue of interviewer bias. This is when the interviewee who is answering the questions may try to answer in a way that the interviewer wants to hear. This may become especially concerning in situations where children are being interviewed by their parents or interviewers who have predisposed belief that the child has been in an abusive home. Another concern that may arise is if the child's statements change drastically over time. For example, say a child makes an abuse allegation against one of their parents, but later retracts it as if it was a lie or a mistake. A lot of the time, this happens because of the pressure from either the parents or the child's feelings of guilt, fear, or loyalty. In Catholic CAS of Toronto versus JL, a 13-year-old disclosed to her doctor that her stepfather had sexually abused her over a video statement, but later retracted the statement after he was charged. It is incredibly important to know these concerns as someone who is questioning children in family cases. But aside from these concerns, one of the best ways to put evidence before the court on the child's best interest is an assessment carried out by a mental health professional. This professional can either be appointed by the court or with mutual consent from both parties. They would want to meet several times with the child over a period of time in a relaxing setting, establishing a rapport with the child and determining whether their preferences are strong and fixed or changing. This kind of report will assess the case and include recommendations about a parenting plan that may or may not be consistent with the child's preferences. While this assessment may provide the most complete report of the child's views, they are expensive and take time to prepare. Fortunately, there is an alternative called the Voice of the Child Report. Some provinces, such as Saskatchewan, British Columbia, and New Brunswick, have programs to assist with the reports, and they are spreading across other jurisdictions in Canada. These reports are shorter, more focused, and can be ordered without parental consent, though most of the time they are prepared on consent. Parents are usually required to pay for these reports, but they are much less expensive than a full mental health professional assessment, and only times a few hours. Voice of the Child reports are usually done by a lawyer or a social worker that have some special training, and they interview the child and prepare a detailed but not verbatim report for the court about what the child has expressed. Through the exploration of the way children are heard, the duties of lawyers, and the perspective of children in family cases, I hope to have opened your minds on the topic of children within the family law system. I also hope that some people can benefit from the information I was able to provide to help their navigation through the family law system. If you'd like some more information, check out this episode on probonoradio.com and take a look at the articles mentioned throughout. You can also tune in weekly to CFRC 101.9, Kingston's only campus and community radio station. Today's show was produced and hosted by yours truly, Raquel Medeiros. If you like this broadcast, you can check out more on Queen's Pro Bono Radio website and on most podcast broadcasting platforms. Thanks for tuning in!